This episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by La Gondola Restaurant. Let host Luigi Vercotti welcome you to all the spicy pleasures of the Mediterranean.
The head waiter will be pleased to show you his specialities. Or why not ask the cook for something really hot?
The head waiter will lead you to exotic pleasures and friendly surroundings. Branches include Chelsea, Parkhurst, Dartmoor, and the Scrubs, and every convenient location to anybody just out of prison. Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hey Ben, good to be with you.
Good to be with you, sir. How is your fine January day treating you?
This is January 11th. It is very nice. Thank you very much.
I will say that this episode, which broadcast on the 11th, only a week after it was recorded, unlike some of the previous episodes, which had a mild delay, 2 to 3 weeks between recording and broadcast, this episode bears interesting hallmarks of the end of the series. We talked in the last episode about how the Pythons had received a memo that their show had been renewed for a second series, complete with dates and projected recording times, so that they were feeling, one assumes, secure in their success.
Mm-hmm.
However, this episode is very peculiar, in my opinion. It has, I often begin these episodes talking about the structure of the episode as I see it. And to me, this episode's structure is a series of callbacks to the previous 12 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
It was right after the hiatus that we had an episode that felt a lot like it was sort of cobbled together by bits of perhaps sketches that hadn't made it or had been cut or was sort of, it was very backwards looking in tone. This is similarly backwards looking, but almost sort of like a victory lap, in that the episode is a series of references to the previous 12 episodes sprinkled in, not so much that it's totally impenetrable, but that it has a quality of feeling like there are a bunch of Easter eggs
mm-hmm.
sprinkled in there for people who have been following the show up until this point that they might recognize, or that the Pythons themselves are feeling good and are just cribbing from themselves by using lots of references to things that had been previously established in the show.
Yeah, I can see the reasoning there. There are a bunch of those that are sprinkled in. I wouldn't say it is the writ large the main theme of this episode, though.
Okay.
There is a bit of that, but it's not just a rehashing of old jokes.
Fair. If there is a theme that is semi-apparent in the first half of the episode, it's definitely a criticism of theaters and cinemas.
Right.
There will now be a short intermission.
The structure of attending an event, but then that sort of bleeds away in a stream of consciousness series of movements between sketches that the show has become so effective at over the course of the second half of the episode, where it doesn't ever return to the theater-going experience after a certain point.
Yeah, that much is pretty clear. Commercialization of films.
Mm-hmm.
And the constant title card of the intermission and the varying size or length of the intermissions that come up.
There will now be a medium-sized intermission.
I believe it comes up 4 times, varying in size from short, medium to whooping great. And with the line, another, how you can turn people away from film are endless advertisements. And they actually produce one of their own advertisements, as was the actual sponsor for this show.
After the show, why not visit the La Gondola restaurant? just 2 minutes from this performance.
Parentheses, not real sponsor. But yeah, that is definitely a theme that comes up in the first part of the show. To me, what is interesting about this episode, this being the last episode, of course, they knew, as we said, that they were going to get a second series. Comes in at 29 minutes.
Yeah.
Which seems like it's on the shorter end of things in terms of the first 13. Part of it seemed pretty slapdash, a little sloppy. And I see this in kind of two different lights. One is they only had a week to get it from studio to broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
This was all filmed in studio on January 4th, and it was broadcast a week later. So that could explain things like, well, the Terry Gilliam's cartoon right at the end seems like there's really no point to it aside from maybe fleshing out an extra 13 seconds of show.
Smart.
It's all in sort of this weird, like, blood red type backdrop, which doesn't really make any sense. And maybe that's just like a technical thing that happened that they didn't have time to correct for. I feel the operational theater sketch seems kind of sloppily tossed together. It's sort of the button on the end of another fairly well-executed sketch about psychiatry. So they had an abbreviated amount of time. That's one way I look at it. The other way is I feel like they had a lot of good ideas that come from the various writing groups, which I think at this point in their Python careers, 13 episodes in, they're all pretty comfortable with now overlapping and sort of cramming different writing talents together in a single sketch. So where you may have two or three disconnected sketches with links in between are now kind of pushed together, smushed together into one longer sketch, which is still less than the sum of three separate sketches. So that has an artificial tendency of shrinking the length of the episode. Specifically what I mean, which one I'm thinking of, the large first segment of the restaurant abuse cannibalism sketch, which seems like a very long Eric Idle monologue with a more conceptual Palin Jones sketch kind of interspersed, for example.
It is a fascinating opening on a number of different levels. The sketch itself doesn't... First of all, on a technical level, let's talk about the fact that almost everybody in the sketch, with the exception of John Cleese, I believe, plays multiple parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have Terry Jones come out at the beginning as the waiter that greets the couple of Eric Idle and John Cleese.
And now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go and commit suicide.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right. It's not because of anything serious.
He then quickly leaves to shoot himself so that he can come back later as the main course.
I hope you're going to enjoy me this evening. I'm the special. Try me with some rice.
Similarly, you have David Ballantyne playing the Greek chorus in a wig and beard and robes, and then he leaves to quickly change costumes into being the underwaiter in a nice white outfit. Almost everybody plays a dual part, up to and including Eric Idle as a cut-in, as a vicar in a stew pot, in a role that he could not possibly have done live on stage. And so it's an interesting bit of, did they cut to a pre-existing film that they projected and showed the audience on a nearby screen? Or did they simply intercut it later? The existence of Ballantyne playing these roles that would normally have been played by Gilliam is interesting in themselves. There's a lot of action physically going on in this sketch, in addition to the tone, which is unlike almost anything else we've seen in Python so far, where the way they're delivering their lines in a very self-aware, performative way, not attempting to play characters. Really, Idle is the only person who's playing a character. Everybody else is reading their lines as if they're reading lines. And there's even a moment where they're very deliberately playing to camera and stepping around each other in order to more aggressively talk to the audience with their punchlines.
I met my second wife at a second wife swapping party. Trust me to arrive late.
It's a very curiously constructed sketch.
I'm wondering if they realize this is the last episode we can get all of our gags in. Maybe they just had whatever was left over they wanted to kind of shoehorn into this sketch. Because it's almost Palin and Jones talking past Cleese and Idle. They don't really have a conversation. It's not really a narrative at all. So maybe they just made the lines work by almost overlapping and not really making one big unit.
It does have I agree with you completely. It has I hate to say this, but it has a dumping ground kind of feel to it, where there is this sense of they're dropping stuff in there and the performance doesn't help. Later on, once we get to the police dealing with the magic issues and we have the surgeon, as much as you may feel like the surgery sketch doesn't necessarily complete itself in terms of the most advantageous punchline as an extension of the psychiatrist sketch, all of the performance leading up to that, you definitely have the characters interacting in a way that we've come to expect, where they're performing off each other, they're live in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this particular sketch, there is a artificiality and a ungroundedness to the way in which they're interacting.
Mm-hmm.
Zany madcap humor, if you will.
If you will. I'm wondering if there were fewer appearances by Gilliam because he was under a tighter deadline to get more cartoons out. There aren't that many cartoons in this episode, except for the one at the end in a couple of intermission-based ones where a big hand takes the intermission and feeds it to some character. I want to say it's Anwar Sadat, but I'm not actually sure that is.
I will point out the woman in the coat check booth, whose name escapes me. She...
Is it Flanagan or Flanagan?
Flanagan, thank you. Yes, actress model Flanagan, who has appeared in a number of prior Python sketches. I believe in the last two episodes ago, she sits down in a chair to watch a television set, which is broadcasting the appearance by the Wood Party, which has always been one of the weirdest links because her presence there is very unusual, even for the kind of blondes that Python is used to using. And here, she's recognizable as somebody that we've seen time and time again in the first series, and she's literally just standing in the background, in frame, doing nothing. And I found her presence a little distracting in that I know that she's been used before, and here she's clearly not being used in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it gives rise to speculation of, I wonder if they had potentially contracted with her that she would appear in four episodes, and then they realized the limits of her ability to contribute, and so they found a spot for her, or whether they just wanted to fill up the room. They had a set, it had a coat check, they didn't want it empty, so they plonked a person in there, even though a dummy would have done just as good a job. There are plenty of different possibilities, and there's really no way of knowing.
Well, like if you remember the restaurant sketch all the way back in episode 3, the Dirty Fork sketch, I believe. They have people in the background there who are a little distracting. Some who just stare right at the camera. So it's not that it hasn't been done before.
Right.
But since we've been talking about the restaurant abuse cannibalism sketch, there seems to be some debate between us about its overall efficacy as a humoristic delivery device. HDD, as I just made that up. It actually tops a list of my favorite sketches for this episode.
Interesting.
Yeah.
There is a particular bit that I wanted to bring up, so I'm glad we're talking about it. But I want to hear from you first what appeals.
Well, I have said before that I appreciate when all the Pythons are together on stage.
Mm-hmm.
That makes me feel like the gears are now intermeshing very effectively and the machine is now running at a more peak efficiency. So I like that idea. Whether or not that's true, we can't really know, but the fact that they produced this is more of an indication. It's less like the Cleese Chapman pair than the Palin Jones pair. We can tell which sketches are which, linked together by something else. I know it's a little bit of a cop-out, but I just like how weird it is.
It's very weird.
It's an odd combination of, minus Cleese, who is just kind of standing there.
Mm.
He doesn't do anything which is patently to his most humorous talents, I suppose. We have Palin and Jones giving, you know, fine performances, and Idol giving a pretty deliciously hateful performance as a slightly more conservative British woman.
I don't like that sort of person at all. I'm playing people and I'm proud of it. My mother's the salt of the earth and I don't take the pill because it's nasty.
Dropping three references to being pregnant and then one about the pill and one about the
river method.
I think is probably a hidden or a thinly veiled criticism of the permissive society where sexual proclivity is probably a little bit looser and maybe a little more accepted. Him, I think, playing a satirical role of poking fun of that kind of woman. I find that nice, and I always like how he can just rattle off long monologues almost with no effort.
Mm.
Another appearance of Terry Jones almost nude. We've mentioned in other episodes how Terry Jones is always the go-to person, it seems, if you want to take your clothes off. He's done it a couple times in the series. He does it more as the organ man in future episodes.
Oh, I don't like that. I think it's silly. It's not a proper sketch. You had a proper punchline.
I don't know. It's just the weirdness of it is what I fancy. I would say it's probably a very difficult sketch to watch if you're new to the Python troupe, because I come preloaded with it, wanting it to work, and then seeing which ways it does work rather than being a little more objective about it. That's my conceit.
I think it's a very particular example of the kind of stream of consciousness writing and performance that we've come to expect from Python.
Mm-hmm.
In that we're used to lack of transitions, we're used to things folding into other things and things moving on. That was very descriptive, Benjamin. Well done. But there is, I might as well just be Eric Idle's character saying,
"Oh, I don't like this. Oh, I don't like that. Oh, I don't think much to all this.
Oh, I don't like that." just repeated the word things four different ways. However, I really got the very strong sense at first that there was a predominance of what I would call dream logic to this sketch. I really did expect it to turn into something where the rules fundamentally didn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when Graham Chapman's character of the headmaster shows up, it really is this extraordinary transition where Michael Palin says,
"Hello, headmaster, what are you doing here?"
You get the sense of, this is totally out of left field. It's as awkward a transition as the psychiatrist wants Carol Cleveland to make later in the episode, where Cleese says, "Couldn't you work the fact that I'm a psychiatrist somewhere into your dialogue?" It has that quality of, why does he need to be a headmaster? The jokes don't really necessitate it. He's mostly making jokes about the fact that he's glad that his wife isn't there.
Mm.
And so it almost has this sense of a mashup of different worlds. If you were to think of it from the perspective of the staff of the restaurant, you can almost think of it as an anxiety dream where you're there and the worst guests in the world show up and they're really obnoxious and they keep talking and your first waiter kills himself and then you're left to deal with these terrible people. And then your headmaster from grammar school shows up and it's this combination of your workplace and your past and anxiety. It has that very strong feeling of surreality to it. So much so that then Michael Palin leans to the camera and says,
"Do you know I still wet my bed?"
Which is this horrific admission, the kind of shame that one would associate with the subconscious revelations. Except that it doesn't build to anything that reveals that it is a dream. It just has that quality to it. So to me, it's very alienating.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm therefore fascinated that you like it. However, the Terry Jones as the meal thing has always appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
It is a marvelous bit. First of all, because Jones plays it very well. He's very, very flirty. The way he slaps Cleese's hands away and laughs.
A Hopkins au gratin à la chef.
Oh, how do you know?
Don't play with the food.
Which is a particular scene that I want to mention because it's very similar to a scene that shows up in Douglas Adams' The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, where Arthur Dent and Zaphod Beeblebrox are at a restaurant. They're at the named Restaurant at the End of the Universe, and a animal comes up and says, "I am your meal tonight. If you'd like to select a cut of me, I'll then nip off and shoot myself humanely so that you can then consume my flesh." And Arthur says, "I don't want to eat an animal that's standing there inviting me to. It's heartless." And Zaphod replies, "Well, is it better than eating an animal that doesn't want to be eaten?" And Arthur wants to protest, but he can't, because actually, all the other animals that we've ever eaten have in fact been killed against their will. And it really messes with his head. And so the weird cannibalistic nature of Terry Jones's character feels like a lift in Restaurant at the End of the Universe. The idea of that he's happy to be eaten, that he's all ready to be Hopkins au gratin à la chef. And we know from M.J. Simpson's biography of Douglas Adams that he loved and watched Monty Python rabidly right from the word go, that he watched the first episode and the entire first series, and that it was a huge touchstone for him prior to him being able to actually write and work with Graham Chapman during the fourth series.
Mm-hmm.
Which has got to be one of the most amazing fan transitions ever, to go from being a 17-year-old schoolboy to within a short number of years being able to work with the people that you idolized. It's the stuff of fan fiction.
My gosh.
I bring it up particularly because it has an interesting perspective on what Adams thought, why he worked with Chapman, was because Chapman didn't feel comfortable working with the other writers after Cleese left, is what the biography says. He really needed to write with another person, and yet he didn't feel comfortable dealing with it. So the passage here says, I think Graham was feeling slightly at a loss because he had always written with John Cleese in the past, so he had to write a lot by himself, and he didn't take too naturally to that. So he said to me, look, if you would help me rewrite this sketch, see if you got any ideas. And that's what it was. I can't remember what it was, actually, but I don't think it was the world's greatest sketch. And in further interviews, he talks about the fact that he didn't feel like he contributed more than a couple of lines or words to the final episode of the fourth series, but that he's one of two people, besides the six members, who gets writing credit in all of Monty Python's Flying Circus, the other person being Neil Innes. Hmm. They're the only two people in the history of Python that get additional credit for the scripts.
Hmm.
There will now be a whopping great intermission.
So, what would your number two favorite sketch be?
It's always an awkward pause right at the end of those thoughts, huh? Number two. So actually, I went back and forth on this one. I watched the episode a couple of times, and this was one that initially did not make it, but then on second and third watching, it was pushed onto my list, and that is Historical Impersonations.
Yes, it's Historical Impersonations, when you in the present can make those in the past stars of the future.
Interesting. I know I just said that about the first one, but it's only because as people who have listened to the entire series of this podcast so far will notice that the top three episodes is Nathan's gig.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the person that comes up with the list. I don't come up with a parallel list, but I do make little predictions in my mind based on my own reactions as to what he will find successful. This episode is such a strange mixed bag that any guess would have been a weird guess. But I'm particularly surprised by this just because it is so episodic that I don't necessarily feel that it's cumulative, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think the jokes are good, but that they don't rise in action.
They do not. There's actually a couple of easy ways this sketch could have been a little more cutting, have a little more weight to it. One being, as you said, could have had a more continuous rise of the things that they have impersonate what. It also could have been a pretty cutting satire if they had, instead of asking old, dead historical people or at the time contemporary sporting celebrities to do impersonations or have their impersonation of them done.
And now your favorite Roman Emperor Julius Caesar as Eddie Waring.
Tota Galliardi vitor est in tres partes.
They could have done like the Prime Minister Heath or the Queen Mum or one of the many prince and princesses do something, which would have been a much more satirical take, but they didn't go that way. And that actually is part of the reason why I like it, because I don't know who any of the people they reference are. I didn't know who Petula Clark was or Eddie Waring or Brian Lennon or W.G. Grace or Graham Hill. They're only a Google search away, which is what I had to do to figure that out. So it's another way of kind of educating me a little bit about 1960s, 1970s England. And also I want to highlight the structure of the sketch is very Palin Jones-like.
Mm.
It always seems to be Palin dressed in a nice jacket, smiling kind of overly gratuitously.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Historical Impersonations.
Kind of greasy palms kind of character talking to the camera, and now we're going to do something that's sounds very important, but it's really very dull. He does this a couple of times. And I have not really applauded that effort before, but I want to in the last episode. Not because it's them, but because I feel like against the other sketches there, it does percolate to the top for me.
Hmm.
Also, if you notice, in one or two of the cutbacks to Palin from the impersonation, you see the camera kind of pivot away from people holding what look like scorecards. Not unlike the most annoying job interview in the world, where people were critiquing something that someone did that was a non-athletic event. In this case, it's how well they impersonated a historical character. They probably taped that on set. And then whoever was directing the footage afterwards said, nope, this does not work. It is now not funny.
Hmm.
So to keep the pace up, there's almost no introduction. Palin just says, welcome to impersonations, and now we're going to have our first impersonation. And boom, there's no fluff at the beginning. And I like how streamlined they've made it. I think partly that's why they you have the same film footage of Palin as Gumby saying, I want to see...
Is that John the Baptist?
John the Baptist impersonate Graham Hill. Right at the front and right at the end of that sketch. It's the same exact footage.
I like to see John the Baptist impersonation of Graham Hill.
And it may have been like, well, we just lost that amount of time due to the camera cutting away from these scorecard holders. So you have to make up that time. So in that interpretation of the sketch, I like how they saw what they did as being a little bit too slow and tried to cut it down.
Hmm.
Of course, I don't have any way of knowing that, but in my head, it makes perfect sense.
I will say that as part of my theory that the episode is chock-a-block full of references,
mm-hmm.
one of the reasons I liked this sketch is because there's an absolute plethora of things that have come up before in this sketch. It starts right off with Cardinal Richelieu singing Petula Clark.
Cardinal Richelieu and his impersonation of Petula Clark.
Which is Michael Palin cutting to Michael Palin. I love it when you have a sketch that's constructed in such a way with bits of film that you have the actor cutting to the actor. But he's in the Cardinal Richelieu outfit that he used way back in episode 3 in the court scene. When we have Eric Idle doing Julius Caesar as Eddie Waring, he's doing the football commentary in the exact same voice that he used when he was the commentator in Famous Deaths in episode 1.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we have Napoleon with the Marseillaise playing.
Napoleon as the R101 disaster.
Which is both a combination of the fact that Napoleon, as played by Terry Jones, shows up later in the episode, but also in episode 2, he plays him as a historical secret mouse. And of course, the Marseillaise plays when Michael Palin has a tape recorder up his nose and his brother's nose in episode 9. And then the sketch wraps up with Marcel Marceau being crushed by a 16-ton weight.
And now Marcel will mime a man being struck about the head by a 16-ton weight.
The third appearance of the weight in the show, in addition to the fourth appearance of the animated weight that crushes a baby carriage full of mobsters.
Right.
So it's callback after callback after callback. And of course, then the sketch cuts to John Cleese interviewing schoolboys Eric and Michael, which itself is also a callback. So there is this pervasive sense, in my opinion, that there's an awareness of this being an episode that establishes a web of previous references, that establishes a intertextual Python where they're pointing out the things that they did before in a very specific manner.
Mm-hmm.
And very specifically, since I mentioned Napoleon, you talk about the idea that the sketch could have been satirical. When we talked about the lampshade reference in the Mr. Hilter sketch, I found that in edgy taste. Here we have Napoleon playing a airplane that went down and killed all of the passengers on board. And the audience laughs like crazy because we have Terry Jones suspended by wires flying across the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're applauding the effort of a man in a Napoleon costume pretending to be an airplane while making a goofy grin at the audience. And they completely forget about the fact that he's effectively portraying the death of hundreds of people. It could have been satirical, but instead, nobody really paid any attention to the fact that they were doing something potentially horrific.
Well, that might fall under the notion that a satire is really only a satire if it's contemporary with the audience.
Mm. And it's true. I believe the plane crash wasn't recent.
Correct. I think it was in the 19-teens, RH-101, I believe. Oh, well, the errata page will show if we are wrong.
And it's about as contemporary as the severed head of John the Baptist in terms of it's a piece of gruesomeness that nobody really is minded by.
Cardinal Richelieu was born in France, so Michael Palin saying, and now it's France's turn, turning to Napoleon, is a historical mistake.
Oh no. You know what? Let's go back and edit the series.
Thank you, Wikipedia. All right. Number 3.
Number 3.
So you've just told me that you make a prediction. I don't know if this is going to be... I think you might be over 3, I'm guessing.
I don't know. There aren't that many sketches in the entire episode that one could choose.
There are not. But also, as you know, I tend to do things chronologically in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
So there are now even fewer. Stonehenge and Mr. Attila the Hun.
Now then, sir, you are Attila the Hun.
That's right, yes. A.T. Hun. My parents are Mr. and Mrs. Norman Hun.
Well, I love it. I'm so glad because Mr. Attila the Hun is such a good performance. It's such a wonderfully weird episode.
Great. I just call it stodgy. I'm not quite sure that's the right word, but it's a word that's tossed around a lot in modern England. Great stodgy character work by Palin.
Mm.
I love his very nasal delivery, very high-pitched. A.T. Hun. And the funny bit about his middle name being, or his nickname being The, and that's how he should be addressed because, hey, we're all friends here.
He's basically playing Arthur Pewty,
mm-hmm.
with the exception of the fact that he's wearing the most ridiculous glasses. I don't know who made the decision. I don't know. I don't believe it's a commentary on the fact that Graham Chapman has just been playing police sergeant in a lovely evening gown inside the department.
Constable, go and see to him, would you? What, in this dress? Oh, I don't go. Oh, I've got a little green penny I can wear.
And that John Cleese is playing a police officer named Sybil. That is why Mr. A.T. Hun is also wearing the oddest pair of horn-rimmed granny glasses and a fierce scarlet that are just completely incongruous with the character. But he's going for it. He's decided that that's the prop he's going to wear, and he's wearing the hell out of them in addition to using that voice and that ingratiating, nebbishy manner.
So I wonder if this is the Pythons just being like, hey, we made it to the end of the first series, and we got greenlit for a second. Let's make this weirder than we might normally.
That's my feeling, yes, yes.
By having Graham Chapman wear a dress and talk about, I can't go out there like this, it's not iron. It's not really where you thought that would go. Having the Chief Constable Joan essentially push Cleese a little violently off frame,
mm-hmm.
and having this mustache, which seems to be sort of randomly used as a thought pivot.
I love the mustache bit, but I can't tell. I can't tell if it's a happy accident of that the mustache wasn't staying on and they just decided to keep the take of him taking it off and forgetting about it, or whether it was always in the script to begin with. It's impossible to guess. I mean, it is printed in the script books, but I don't know if that's part transcript or original intent. There are always things in the scripts that don't make it onto screen. For example, the description of Napoleon when he comes into the psychiatrist's office.
Come in.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Ah, Mr. Phelps, come on in. Take a seat. Now, what seems to be the matter?
No.
Is that he is wearing a Napoleon outfit, he has a parrot on his shoulder, and he's holding a lead or a leash to an empty dog collar, as if he's walking an invisible dog into the office, which is why he says bow wow wow when he comes in. He's supposed to be doing the voice of his fake dog. That's how crazy he is. Except he doesn't have the lead. He doesn't have the fake invisible dog leash. And so he just says bow wow wow anyway in a strange moment of complete absurdity that is never then referred back to, because his character decides, actually no, this sketch isn't good enough for me to appear in. I'm off.
Will you please sit down and do your first line?
No, I've had enough.
Unless you can do something original. So here, similarly, we have a completely surprising twist in that we think the sketch is about one sort of thing, about a man coming in claiming to be Attila the Hun, except it's just a coincidence because his parents named him that as a joke, but he's taking responsible for the over 9,000 murders that Attila the Hun perpetrated in the past. Except that then, upon blowing into a breathalyzer, it's proved that he's not Attila the Hun, but is in fact
Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great.
He's Alexander the Great.
Aha! Caught you, Mr. A.T. Great.
Oh, curses!
Because it's the Alexander the Greatalyzer.
To which I say, why is he arrested? I'm not entirely sure what war crimes Alexander the Great is responsible for. Maybe that's just my own Western prejudice and my having absorbed the fact that people are pretty much, they think that Alexander is in fact the great and Attila is in fact the not great. But at the same time, yeah, we're sort of good on Alex. And yet, he seems to be dragged off in cuffs for having impersonated a different historical character.
Hmm. Before we move on to the next segment, some things at the top I wanted to point out, which we may cut later. I'm not sure.
Hit me.
So the A.T. Hun, the Mr. Attila the Hun sketch, seems to me like it's written by Palin and Jones, just because they're the two top billed actors in the scene. That tends to follow with who wrote it. It seems like a silly narrative, which is more indicative of the Cleese Chapman style of writing.
Okay.
And you contrast that with the psychiatry sketch, which is a much more high concept, exploratory, obscure setup, which is more indicative of the Jones Palin writing style.
Except that there's a deliberate gag in there where they use a thesaurus.
Cross the threshold, arrive, ingress, gain admittance, infiltrate.
Which is indicative of the Chapman-Cleese combination, where he literally looks up synonyms for come in and then reads them off in order to invite Mr. Knotlob, yet another reference.
And Dr. Lurch.
That's right. Yet another callback. It's all callbacks, I'm telling you.
And also the line,
oh, it drives me mad.
With that horrible underbite, just like Bungo from the restaurant sketch.
I've got a whole list of these. I'm ready to go at any second. And so I would prefer to think that that is Cleese and Chapman being aware of the fact that this is their go-to reference and therefore poking fun at themselves more than I would prefer to think that that is Jones and Palin being like, all right, guys, we've got your system, and therefore we're going to take a swap at you in the middle of an episode that's going to be on the show.
Right. I think it's them, the writers themselves, having fun with what is essentially their stereotypical writing style. But just those two sketches seem like the styles are, they've swapped for that one example. So maybe they're trying to break out of the shell they find themselves, they sort of tend to put themselves in, giving themselves a little key with a thesaurus in the middle of the sketch.
I think any writer obviously vacillates between those two poles of feeling hidebound by what they always do and worrying that they're in a rut and knowing that where they go to is where they've gotten their best successes. And so you want to stretch and do things that are different. You want to try new things and push yourself. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you don't want to fail. And your past successes have come from a certain source or a certain technique. And so therefore, you're likely to go back to that if you're feeling vulnerable or if you want to actually just do the work. And particularly work that's on a deadline, you don't necessarily have a lot of chance to try things that are new.
One of the sketches that did not make my list was the, do you want to come back to my place?
Inspector,
mm-hmm.
I'm terribly sorry, but I was sitting on a park bench over there, took my coat off for a minute, and then I found my wallet had been stolen and £15 taken from it.
And I only bring that up now because in my research for this episode, there appeared a discrepancy in the references as to who wrote this sketch.
Okay.
Now, in the Python's autobiography on the Pythons, I'll quote Michael Palin here. The brief come back to my place sketch where I propositioned John as a policeman, this was just done on the spot. So a certain amount of improvisation was done on film, unquote. So by that token, this is something that just was sort of happening. They had a few moments while somebody was setting up and they just had the idea and they ran with it. However, on the Monty Python Wikipedia page, the sketch is referenced as being written by Graham Chapman. And the reference is a book by a man named Jim Yaucom entitled Graham Chapman, Fuzzy Memories, Silly Bits, and Outright Lies, which attributes the writing of that sketch to Graham. Never mind the title outs him as a through and through liar. Also, never mind the fact that Palin's quote refers to Cleese as being costumed for the Piranha Brothers sketch, which would not have been filmed for at least another year. So if it is just a little bit of improvised creativity on the spot or a sketch that was premeditated by one of the Pythons themselves, is unclear.
I just rewatched the film Pride, which is about a series of political actions taken by gay and lesbian groups in the, I want to say, the early 70s. So maybe a couple of years after this show took place. And it's about them doing fundraising in order to support the miners during a strike under Thatcher. And it's a really extraordinary film. One of the key plot points in it is that there's a discrepancy in the age of consent. that when one is gay, one doesn't have the ability to choose to be intimate with a partner until one is 21, whereas if one is straight, the age of consent is 16.
Hmm.
And that this came about because there was a law that was passed very soon before this episode was written, produced, and aired that changed the criminal penalties for homosexual acts. And I want to find this so I don't get it wrong. But that this brief sketch also has the opportunity of showing that consenting adults had the ability to do what they wanted without fear of recrimination if everybody was over 21. And that while you might need a completely ludicrous excuse to ask in the first place, the audience laughs. The audience thinks it's pretty amazing. But 1967 was the Sexual Offenses Act. So in the very, very recent past was the ability for gay partners to have interaction without it being criminalized, which had been around since, it says here, 1861. But that there were a number of high-profile convictions in the 50s that had caused the Wolfenden Report to be commissioned to recommend decriminalizing that activity.
Hmm.
So it's only in the very recent past that this would have been allowed. And that's potentially part of the heart of the sketch, which lends credence to the idea that it might have been scripted by Chapman, but doesn't prove anything.
Hmm.
I'll also mention that 15 pounds, since I've been doing consistent calculations of monetary values over the course of the series, 15 pounds doesn't necessarily sound that much, but would have been the rough equivalent of 211 pounds in today's money, or $271 in 2019.
Wow.
So the idea that you'd left a wallet with 15 pounds in it and it disappeared, and then a police officer said, well, if you didn't see anything, there's really not much we could do about it, would have been pretty heartbreaking, to be completely honest with you. I might have wanted a little policeman comfort myself after that.
Okay, everybody, it's that time of the show.
Dun da da!
Probably first, second, or third favorite part of this show. The Monty Python Minute.
Monty Python Minute.
Where we consult our good cyber friends and algorithms therein at random.org to pick one whole minute of the Monty Python episode, Intermission, or It's the Arts, episode 13, with which Ben must give me in 30 seconds a summary of what went on in that 1 minute of the episode. And in that time afterwards, I am going to give him a certain amount of time, haven't decided yet how long, to answer not six, not seven, but eight questions pertaining to information that only loosely, circumspectedly...
Information I have not prepared for in any way.
only references that minute in the most loosest of ways possible. Okay, Ben. Are you ready for your Monty Python Minute?
How could I not be ready? I've been training my whole life for this.
If your whole life was the last 10 seconds, that would be true. Random.org has given me the minute 13. That is minute 13.
What's your name?
Eric.
Would you like to have a 16-ton weight dropped on top of you, Eric?
Don't know.
Okay, Ben. Whenever you're ready, you have 30 seconds to summarize minute 13. And whenever you're ready...
I get to pick. I get to start. You're not going to count me down.
All right. You now have the oh-so-welcome challenge of summarizing minute 13 of Monty Python's episode 13, Total Coincidence, starting now.
Cutting from Wembley Stadium, John Cleese is interviewing Eric and Michael as schoolchildren. He asks whether or not Eric would like to have a 16-ton weight dropped on him. Michael says that he'd like to have Raquel Welch dropped on top of him. And Eric says that she'd have a big bottom. And John Cleese mugs for the camera. There's some confusion as to
10 seconds.
Why would like that. Then it cuts to Cleese interviewing Trevor Atkinson, which is Graham Chapman as well. He says that he's 42, and they're kneeling in the same position as the children.
Time. Well done. Well done. There is really not a whole lot in this 1 minute.
No, I lucked out. It was a lot of silence and a lot of cutting to a theater full of people applauding, which gave me less things to actually describe.
Exactly.
I will point out here, I was prepped for this minute accidentally by having done a little bit of focus on this minute because I was confused as to what Michael Palin says when he says that he'd like to have Raquel Welch dropped on top of him.
Mm-hmm. And have Raquel Welch dropped on top of me.
Dropped on top of you.
Oh yes, not calmly.
Because Cleese says, dropped on top of you. And according to the subtitles, Palin says, yeah, not climbing, which doesn't make any sense to me at all. And so I went and I checked the script, and the script also says, yes, not climbing. But to my ears, he says, yes, not carnally, which makes so much more sense.
Doesn't it?
That he's a weird schoolboy who would like Raquel Welch, and the audience is all like, well, of course you'd like Raquel Welch. We'd all like Raquel Welch. And then he goes, no, I'd like her dropped on top of me instead of a 16-ton weight. I wouldn't like her carnally. That's weird. I'm a schoolboy. That, I've always thought that that would be what the line is, and the fact that the script books and the subtitles all disagree with me, I don't know what to do with that information.
That is a point. I actually have the same thought. But yes, like you, I had looked at the scripts, at least the ones that were available to me online. They did say not climbing, which might be some deep cut reference that we are unaware of.
Yeah.
So even in the Monty Python, all the words, it does say not climbing?
Yes, it does.
Interesting.
Bizarre.
Okay. Ben, your task now is you have to answer 8 questions, almost all of which deal with
climbing.
The very decidedly non-Python person who's referenced in this 1 minute, Raquel Welch. Question 1. In 1970, when episode 13 was broadcast, how old would Raquel Welch would have been? Is it A,
32,
25, B, 27, C, 29, or D, 31?
Well, okay. I was going to guess D, 31, based on my quick to the halter joke, but actually, 20s is typical for models in their prime. She made Bedazzled in 65. She made Dr. No in 63. Was 27 one of the options, or 28?
27.
27.
She would have been 29, but you are very close. Your reasoning was honest to you. Question 2. Who has been married more times, Raquel Welch or John Cleese?
Okay. I don't know if I'm right, but I believe John Cleese has been married 4 times. So I'm going to say Raquel Welch has been married more.
Your logic is pretty sound, but it's a trick question. They've both been married 4 times.
Oh, come on!
Number 3. Who has been divorced more times? Raquel Welch or John Cleese?
Wait a minute. I recognize that I'm not very good at math, but surely those two things should be equal.
You can be married and not divorced.
Meaning, okay, one of their 4th marriages could be over and the other one could not be.
Yes.
I'm going to say Cleese has been divorced more.
Incorrect. Cleese has only been divorced 3 times. Yeah. He is still currently married to a lady named Jennifer Wade, married 2012. Question 4. Raquel Welch has been nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy in 1974's The Three Musketeers, which she won. John Cleese was nominated for a Golden Globe that he did not win for Best Actor in a Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy for what movie?
No year.
Not at this point. You can ask for a hint.
Because I know, you know, Richard Lester's 1974, Richard Lester, who came up previously with the Running, Jumping, and Standing Still film as the director of The Three Musketeers. But if I don't know what year John Cleese was nominated for Golden Globe, then I have all of his career to guess. I could guess it was The Out-of-Towners. I could guess it was... I'm going to say, however, probably A Fish Called Wanda.
Fish Called Wanda, yes, you're correct. Ding, 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 ding. Good night. Number 5. Under the auspices of the Oracle of Bacon, who has a smaller Bacon number? Of course, for the audience, the Bacon number is the number of films it takes to be linked with the actor Kevin Bacon.
I think it's Cleese, based because of Rat Race, or Out-of-Towners. Either one of those could get Cleese to Bacon within 1 or 2.
So Cleese is your answer?
Yes.
Yeah, you're correct. Ding, ding, ding. The website, The Oracle of Bacon, listed the movie The Big Picture, though I'm sure there are other movies that could link in. Raquel Welch is a Bacon number of two. She was in Flare Up in 1969 with Ron Rifkin, who unfortunately was given a fake obituary, who is in fact not dead.
Huh.
And Ron Rifkin was in JFK in 1991 with Kevin Bacon.
JFK is a great 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon one. It's important to remember both Sleepers and JFK and A Few Good Men when remembering Kevin Bacon. Those are the ones that you can find most male actors who have been in pretty much everything.
Question six. According to IMDb, John Cleese and Raquel Welch share one film credit together. Is it A, The Magic Christian, B, The Statue, C, Shoot Loud, Louder, I Don't Understand, or D, Fathom?
Well, I don't know what those last three are, but I know that The Magic Christian is a Ringo Starr, Peter Sellers vehicle that where Raquel Welch stars as a, or features prominently, stars would be drastically overstating her role, as a Viking ship commander, and Cleese and Chapman wrote a scene for it, and I believe Cleese appears as a person in an art museum, much like the role that he reprises later when he appears on Doctor Who with Douglas Adams.
That is correct. Word for word, that was my exact answer. Shoot Loud, Louder, I Don't Understand is a Raquel Welch credit.
All right.
That's all I got. I'm throwing my hands up. I've never seen it. Okay, this will make question seven go pretty quickly. Many other actors credited in The Magic Christian are affiliated in the Monty Python ethos. What names are not involved with The Magic Christian? I think actually it's going to be very easy. Is it A, Peter Sellers, B, Ronnie Barker, C, Ringo Starr, D, Graham Chapman, or E, Spike Milligan?
Oh, so it's going to be either Barker or Milligan. And to be honest with you, I don't remember which one of them isn't in Magic Christian. So it's a coin flip. I'm going to say Milligan isn't actually in it.
Milligan is in it.
Ah.
It is actually Ronnie Barker is not in that movie. Fact. Spike Milligan plays Traffic Warden 27.
Of course. He's so famous for that. Why didn't I recognize him?
And the final question of this round is a curveball. When John asks, "What is your name?" Eric Idle responds, "Ewick," which is a speech impediment and the inability to pronounce your R's as common amongst children. The clinical name of this speech impediment is known as what? Is it A, dysprosia, B, rhylanopathy, C, guttural clamping, or D, rhotacism?
Dysprosia.
That is incorrect. It is rhotacism. Dysprosia is the oxide formed with dysprosium, one of the periodic table elements.
Wait, there's an element on the periodic table called dysprosium?
Dysprosium.
What number is that?
It's in the high 80s. 60, sorry. Dysprosium is a chemical element with the symbol Dy and atomic number 66. It is a rare earth element with a metallic silver luster.
Huh. I think I would have recognized that from Tom Lehrer's song The Element, especially with that low of a number.
Dysprosium, four syllables. He kind of crams it in there.
He does. And he doesn't do them in order either. So there are a bunch of mumbles in the middle where when I've tried to memorize it, I've been like,
The inability to pronounce your R's is a speech impediment common amongst children, but is also a speech impediment that befalls characters like Elmer Fudd. The evil heroine played by Madeline Kahn in Blazing Saddles, known as Lily von Stoop, and most notably Pontius Pilate in Monty Python's Life of Bwine.
Nice connection, sir. Yes, a problem with one's liquids, as I believe those consonants are called.
Yeah, okay. That is the end of the Monty Python Minute. Thank you very much, Ben. Care to introduce the top five moments?
I would. I would be glad. Top five moments. A moment, to recap, is not a sketch or an entire huge scripted segment, but a piece of time or performance, a line reading or a glance, a way in which we can appreciate elements of performance in the overall show by focusing in on discrete, as we say, moments in each episode. And I will start with number one in my top five, There is a marvelous line that Eric Idle gives in the middle of his terrible list of all the things that he says as she in the introduction, the restaurant slash cannibalism sketch, where after Michael Palin has talked about the fact that this is a vegetarian restaurant and goes on a lengthy tirade about all the terrible things that they don't do to animals, Idle says,
"I'm against people who give vent to their loquacity by extraneous bombastic circumlocution."
And the sketch stops and everybody just stares at her. And then she goes, "Oh, I don't like that." It's such a great line. And I appreciate it, despite the fact that I am 100% in favor of people who give vent to their loquacity by extraneous bombastic circumlocution. In fact, I am guilty of it all the time. It is kind of my go-to move at work and in arguments.
Just to wear people down.
Yes! You don't necessarily need to win when logic on your side, when you have a vocabulary that you can use as a blunt instrument to render people insensate. You stuff enough $5 SAT words into a sentence and they become so discombobulated they don't know whether or not you've actually made a good point. It is the way I win. However, it is a useful phrase to both subvert and demonstrate that kind of technique, and I loved it.
Well, great. That was actually on my list as well. I'm going to put out
Ivan the Terrible as a sales assistant in Freeman, Hardy, and Willis.
He obviously was not part of the A.T. Great or A.T. Hun. He is I.T.T. It reminds me a little bit of the Weird Al Yankovic film where they have Conan the Librarian, who summarily slices a patron in half with his colossal broadsword. It's 2 seconds, and I appreciate the calmness with which the other customer sits and gets a momentary, like, twitch of his eye as the sword comes down and bifurcates the puppet in the shape of Graham Chapman.
It's interesting that you think the puppet's in the shape of Graham Chapman. I spent some...
That was just like a spur-of-the-moment thought. It's like a blonde-haired dummy.
I slowed down the footage and did step-by-step fast-forward on the DVD because there's some weird editing there. There's a very brief close-up shot of Cleese's Attila raising the sword before it then cuts back to the wide shot of him slicing down into the dummy, which is disconcerting. But what's interesting is that the shot is set up so that there's a live man sitting next to the dummy to give you the impression that they were both alive to begin with. He's sort of just not really blinking and twitching his leg a little bit. The organs in the middle of the bifurcated dummy are great. Like, there's attention to detail in the slit in half. The way in which he's held together before he gets cut into is quite good, but the wig is terrible, and the face is very weird. In fact, the face looks more like Gilliam than anybody else, and I don't know if that's just because Gilliam has that kind of stretched, wide face with that long, thin mouth that he has. So I did wonder, it did occur to me, as to whether or not the dummy had originally been created based on Gilliam for some fun event that they were planning on doing, or whether it was just something that was lying around the BBC, or whether they special ordered it. There doesn't seem to be any comment about it specifically for me to know. But I would say it looks like Gilliam in a bad wig, which is mostly what Gilliam looks like on the show.
Number three!
In the psychiatrist sketch, and when it turns into the surgery sketch, we find that we have a man who has a number of squatters in him playing folk music.
What are you doing in there?
We're doing our own thing, man.
Have you got Mr. Notlob's permission to be in there?
We're squatters, baby.
And Graham Chapman slices him up a treat in order to get inside. And Eric Idle pokes his head out as a trippy hippie, and he has the marvelous line,
"Don't get uptight, man, join the scene," and other phrases, "Money isn't real."
And I love the "and other phrases" part of that. It lends credence to the idea that they were getting rushed at the end, and that his dialogue is so peppered full of touch-tone little hippie moments, and they just sprinkle them all in there. And I like the fact that at some point he had a draft where he was like, "Yeah, and other phrases." And they were all like, "Yeah, leave that in. Leave that in. That's great. Just don't even bother finish writing it. we're good with that as it is. It's a stupid little postmodern deconstructionalist bit, and I think it's both appropriate to the character and appropriate to the sense of we were on deadline for this episode, and we didn't bother coming up with the most polished of drafts.
Number four, the end of the Me Doctor sketch.
Mr. Burtonshaw?
Me Doctor?
No, me Doctor, you Mr. Burtonshaw.
My wife Doctor?
No, your wife Patient, me Doctor.
This is a fun little sketch, some typical wordplay. I think it's more of a idle construction. But what I like about the ending is the knight with the chicken, who used to be brought on as sort of a punitive measure for quote-unquote bad jokes or cheesy punchlines.
Mm-hmm.
In this sketch, it's meant to sort of lock it away or put a sealant on the sketch, which has really just gone off the rails. It seems like the idol character has kind of gotten lost in this assemblage, this sort of word soup.
You tree, you drink, you triller, you tent, euphemism. Me Doctor.
That he can't really quite re-rail it, and all the other actors know it, and they kind of look awed at themselves. John Cleese even looks into the camera. Sort of in a way the Colonel used to do, where come on saying, sorry, this sketch has gotten too silly.
Right.
But now, because the sketch is self-aware, they've just put in the knight in there, probably because it was a quick and easy thing to do. And the knight sort of wipes it clean. And it finishes with Albatross, which is now a intra-episode reference.
Albatross!
Which I like.
There are six uses of the word albatross in the albatross sketch, and then five additional call-outs to the albatross sketch over the course of the episode. For number five, I'm going to close it off by, since you talked about the knight, this is the last time the knight appears in the entire series. He showed up a number of times in series one to varying degrees of success, but I also consider him to be one of the many, many callbacks over the course of the episode. In addition to Luigi Vercotti appearing, in addition to the Undertakers, the Larch, the use of one blank later, where here it's one court order later, whereas in episode 11, two before, it was one lobotomy later for Inspector Targer of the Yard. There's so many instances in here of things referring to previous things. So I could point to the Viking, who was played by David Ballantyne, who plays the waiter and the Greek chorus, because I thought it was interesting at first. At first I thought, I was like, oh, there's Gilliam in the Viking suit, and it took me peering closer to recognize that no, it's this weird, fresh-faced young man who's just randomly showing up in this episode. But I think the callback that made me the most happy, that surprised me the most, was when Terry Jones's Napoleon storms out of the office of the psychiatrist, and Cleese calls after him, you know, won't you even read your first line? And he says, no. I loved all of the different references to lines and the fact that they're aware of the fact that they're reading a script. It's consistently one of my favorite parts of the show. You have two earlier ones in this episode where during the first opening restaurant sketch, when Cleese delivers one of his bad jokes at the beginning, Terry Jones says,
that's why I said we get all sorts of lines in here.
Again, highlighting the fact that this script is kind of finished, kind of not finished. But it also refers back to episode 8 with Harold Cleveland's only line in Buying a Bed, and Art Critic, my only line, with Terry Gilliam as a Viking having his only line. This is my only line is my consistent favorite bit of Python. And so anything that has a line of a person not delivering their line, much in the way that Michael Palin doesn't give the punchline in the various international suitors waking him up in the bed in the middle of the night, but instead he leaves before the sketch is over. That's always, that particular kind of deconstruction always is what makes me the happiest. And so for Terry Jones to say, no, I'm not doing this and leaving, it's great. I didn't think anything could be funnier than his him hanging from wires and being a plane crash Napoleon, but his Napoleon in this sketch is wonderful.
With a parrot on top of his hat, no less.
Yes, yes, making Napoleon look vaguely piratical.
And then have him be in frame to criticize or admonish the start of other sketches, which he chose not to be in.
It cuts to him judging Cleese's inability to do something new and different in the sketch.
This episode of the Python Perspective was conceived, researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design also by the two of us.
Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song,
thank you,
is by John Philip Sousa and sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at pythonpod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, dates, names, faces, albatrosses, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan, my co-host is Ben.
See you next time!
This ends the first series of Monty Python. We will get back to the airwaves once season 2 is conceived, written, performed, and edited. Of course, the first episode in series 2, Face the Press, or Dinsdale.
But also features the return of Harry Snapper Organs, played by a different person, and having upgraded from H division to Q division over the course of the interim and the body change.
That's the best way to get a promotion in any job, is to get a body change.
So look forward to that and additional commentary when we return for the 50th anniversary of Series 2, Episode 1.